If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, equal housing lender, MLS 112-4061.
February is Black History Month, though I've never understood why it's been relegated to only one month. Today, I've got a Black History story. We talked about it a bit with Jeff Carlin and our guest today, Professor Charles Lipson, as we were sitting down to make this podcast, and in my weekend column, I promised to tell it here. So I don't know if I put myself in a box, but here it goes. You've got to get in the Wayback Machine to 1987, when the late Mayor Harold Washington died, leaving a great power vacuum in Chicago. I was a young reporter, mostly stuck on crime and the political crime beat, ferreting out crony contracts, who got what deal. At the paper then, they thought I could handle that because, well, they thought of me as something of a wharf rat. I wasn't smooth. I didn't go to the right college. I didn't have a pedigree. Two men emerged as contenders for Washington's mantle. The late Eugene Sawyer, alderman of the then-powerful 6th Ward, and then 4th Ward Alderman Tim Evans, who is now the chief judge of the Cook County Circuit Court. And at a so-called memorial service for Washington that was held at the UIC Pavilion, jammed with thousands and thousands of people. Even Lori Lightfoot told me once that she was there. It was really a campaign rally for Evans. And there, allegedly or supposedly mourning Washington, the hard left unleashed a weapon that we really hadn't seen before. It was the weaponization of race, that business of who's black enough, of defining someone's politics based on the color of their skin, and whether they were true to that skin pigment. Yes, it's debilitating, and yes, you've seen it since. Even Barack Obama was accused of not being black enough when he began his political career. And this was where it started, at that Washington-Evans rally. And I don't think you're going to hear much about it during Black History Month, but I feel like telling it. It was ugly. Gene Sawyer, who marched with Dr. Martin Luther King, was depicted as a race traitor. Tim Evans, who climbed up through the machine holding the coat of Claude Holman, was the hero. Vernon Jarrett, the Sun-Times columnist, babbled insane things at the microphone, spittle coming out of his mouth, accusing Sawyer of being just like militiamen killing black babies. It was ugly. It was sickening, and it broke black politics in Chicago and ushered in the reign of Chicago Mayor Richard M. Daley, a.k.a. Fredo. Well, even then, the news was liberal, and people didn't want to touch the subject head on, but I came up with an idea, and I talked about it and talked it out with Tribune artist Judy Anderson, and she put it on paper. I wanted Sawyer and Evans holding Greek theater masks up to their faces, the masks on sticks, the masks being the face of the late Mayor Harold Washington. And I wrote about the use of symbolism in politics, the wretched ugliness of it all, the idea of skin color as ideology, the beginnings of identity politics. We didn't call it identity politics then. It was published on February 28, 1988, under the headline, Who Will Wear the Mantle? But it was really all Judy Anderson, her skill, her with pen and ink, on the front of the old perspective page of the paper. Those politicians holding up their theater masks. But it jump-started my career, because at the paper, they stopped thinking of me strictly as a wharf rat. I remember Jack Fuller, the executive editor, and my friend, who told me later that after that, he thought I might be able to think a bit. Things change. Today we'll talk race and politics and more, and President Joe Biden's plans to select the Supreme Court nominee solely on the basis of race and gender. And we'll talk with our good friend, Charles Lipson, the Peter B. Ritzma Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago. He's a frequent contributor to Real Clear Politics, Spectator World, Newsweek, American Greatness, The Wall Street Journal, and others. And our buddy and co-host, Jeff Carlin, executive producer at WGN Radio, is here too. Here as always. Always here, Jeff. In an unexpected twist, Jeff and Charlie lead me to talk about things that shape me. Things that were tough to talk about. That mule in the village. What happened to my father during the war when the blue-eyed Carabinieri officer broke down the door of our house in our village. And what happened when the communists tried to take over. But where are you now as we touch on Chicago and race and civil wars in countries long ago? Where are you when we select Supreme Court justices based on immutable characteristics like race and gender? You're on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
What do we do if we give him a chance and he goes out and hijacks a car? Do we throw him away? No, we don't give up on the kids. We continue to try to help them.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
As promised and as tweeted, our next guest is Charles Lipson, the professor from the University of Chicago, emeritus now, the Peter B. Ritzma Professor Emeritus, and a frequent contributor to Real Clear Politics, Spectator World, Newsweek, Discourse Magazine, American Greatness, and the Wall Street Journal, among others. I'm still waiting for him to write for johncastnews.com, but I'm not going to put any public pressure on my good friend.
John, I have a prior request to write for supermarket flyers.
Thank you. Okay. Well, you know what? Because Charles is big time, and don't ask him to write for free, because his Dr. Johnson, Dr. Samuel Johnson, I believe, informed the literary world several centuries ago, the only person who writes for free is a jackass. So, Charles, you are not a jackass. I'm looking at three articles that you've just written that were delicious.
Absolutely.
One is, can Putin ever be stopped? Another is, the little president who cried racism. And the third is, the progressive logic of Build Back Better. Now, you can find all these, listeners, you can find all these by going to charleslipson.com, and you'll find these articles and more. And
actually, I have another one today, John.
Oh, let's see. Yeah, you mentioned. Wait.
Yeah, Real Clear Politics picked it up.
Yeah. Yeah, I have this week, the Supreme Court heard a case on affirmative action, which in the past they have ruled was legal, but probably should be fading out over time. And really, it's been in place for almost six decades in one way or another. And it looks likely that it will fade out. And my article, or be ruled illegal, and my article is, how will universities, in effect, stand in the schoolhouse door and keep their old policies without being found to be illegal? And my short answer to that is, they're going to drop all standardized tests, which will leave numerical evidence that they are discriminating, so they can discriminate behind closed doors. And they've sometimes they've actually said the quiet part out loud, and I quote that in the article. So as you said, these are all posted at charleslipson.com, your finest, or your second finest site for op-ed opinions after John Cass News.
Listen, the headline of Charlie's piece is, how universities will sidestep SCOTUS on affirmative action, Charles Lipson, RCP. And our good friend Tom Bevan has put that up there high and where it belongs. Which brings me to our first question, gentlemen, to both of you. Charlie first, though. Given we're talking about discrimination and use of race and other immutable characteristics to keep some people out and other people in, which is completely anti-American. It's completely anti-merit. And it's something that Greeks and Jews and now Asians have hated because it's been used to keep these groups down.
Right.
And away from university life.
Right.
So I ask you, if I were president and announced that I would only select, I don't know, for the Supreme Court, we need a swimmer, we need a transgender female swimmer, and no others shall be considered but former males who are now transgender swimmers, females, would that be in violation of not only propriety, but also the law, as the Supreme Court has ruled?
Yes, it would be, but, or it probably would be, but Supreme Court nominations have always had a political dimension.
Of course.
Jonathan Turley, a Chicago guy,
yeah,
who is now one of the sort of top commenters on a lot of these Supreme Court issues, pointed out exactly the answer to your question in the last day or two, saying if anybody tried to do what Biden is doing on Supreme Court appointees at the level of college or corporate hiring or anything else, it would be found to be illegal. But it's not illegal for the president to say, I'm going to appoint anybody to any position for any kind of political reason. If he said, I'm never going to appoint, in this case, he basically said, I'm not going to appoint a male, I'm not going to appoint a white person, I'm not going to appoint Hispanic, In fact, I tweeted that I thought that it was an opening for Republicans who are gaining substantially in the Hispanic vote to point that out.
Right.
What did you say, Jeff?
I said that's a great point.
You know, I think that, but I don't think it's in any sense illegal. I think the question is, how strong a person will he really appoint? And let me make one maybe non-obvious point here. If you go back to the George W. Bush years, Bush wanted to appoint his personal attorney to the Supreme Court, Harriet Myers.
Disaster.
It was a disaster. And not because she would have voted, quote, the wrong way. The reason conservatives ended up opposing it is that they wanted a strong intellectual voice. And that's going to be the issue, I think, now for Biden. The conservatives don't just have the most votes. They have the intellectual heft. And the arguments are being made by the conservatives. And if what Biden does is appoint just one more vote, somebody who is far less powerful intellectually than Justice Breyer is, then it will hurt his side.
But how do you finesse that if you're in the opposition? I can't.
You can't. And I in can't fact, you run a danger.
Yeah.
You run a danger because you will look as if you might be opposed to having someone who is an African-American woman and therefore increase the turnout of people on the other who are voting against your side in the midterms.
And that's, I mean, but that's the point about is Republicans to take advantage of this, or the way for them to use it would be to point out the shortcomings there, especially among Hispanics, because we've seen in places like Florida and Arizona and even California, where, you know, Hispanic populations are very conservative. They're following their, you know, religious views as well as who's reaching out to them. I mean,
and they're not happy about the illegal immigration. If Biden thinks that he's helping by having an open southern border, he's wrong. Well, of course, everybody knows that there are problems there. One thing I point out in the article, Jeff and John, is that I think in the big civil rights laws that demanded the end of Jim Crow laws and a lot of the informal discrimination in the North, Jim Crow laws in the South, those were done in the mid-60s. So we're now, you know, more than 50 years on, more than half a century on. You know, the public, the American public, is very pragmatic, and they understood that when those laws were, when the new laws came in place, you couldn't just expect people who'd been educated in segregated schools and, you know, basically kept on cotton plantations and so forth to compete on an equal terms right away. So the idea that you could give people a slight advantage in college education or in employment or something, and that it would fade away over time, that had a lot of support. But the idea was that the advantage should be small, and it should not be a permanent advantage. And I think that that's what's happened. It's turned into a large advantage that's not getting smaller. And the people who favor affirmative action want to make it a permanent feature of American law, which, as John said, it just turns our most basic constitutional values of non-discrimination on its head.
It is also completely unfair to those it purports to help.
That's an interesting point, and it's now become increasingly obvious If you look at there was Jason Riley, himself an African-American columnist who often writes for the Wall Street Journal, wrote an article the other day in which he cited some research from Duke University. And basically what it said was that the white students who come in and intend to major in the sciences and as freshmen intend to major in sciences or some of the hard social sciences, hard statistical and mathematical social sciences like economics, they end up doing that almost entirely. But if you look at African-American students who are admitted to Duke on a disproportionately affirmative action basis, something like almost half of them end up switching out of those hard majors into something easier. And the premise here, I think, is that if they didn't go to Duke but went to a university where their test scores and grade points in high school were closer to the average, they would actually be able to succeed in the majors that would allow them later to become doctors and computer programmers and all the rest. They wouldn't end up switching into urban studies. That at least is the premise, and there's increasing evidence that that is so.
It is just demeaning as well. Yeah. Demeaning to have, I remember a colleague of mine, African-American,
yep,
brilliant, although he went to the dark side, Dean Baquet, who I blame for the 1619
project. Oh, yeah. Project. Well, he became very prominent.
Yes, but he's now the editor of the New York Times. But Dean Baquet.
Whatever happened to that paper?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I don't know, but Dean Baquet was a great writer and reporter, thinker, and organized, I mean, in every way. He was beyond, beyond good as what he did, and was awarded a Pulitzer Prize. To lump him with others who may not have had, you know, been of his standard would be, to me, infuriating.
Well, that is what happened. I'll give you a couple of examples that are not racial at all. When I went to college, it was a pretty, it was hard to get into the college I went to, and they had finally opened up to a general, to SAT scores and things. So they didn't just admit you if you went to a good prep school and your right. mom and dad were rich. But the school was basically divided into two groups. One, I used to say, one were the people who had, like, not just a Roman numeral after their name, but a large Roman numeral. They were 3, 4, or 5, you know. and the other were the people whose dad was the best orthodontist in Scarsdale. Okay, and it was not at all unclear who were the smarter students, but there was one student in our class, or in a class or two ahead of us, and he was known as Books. That was his nickname.
Oh, nice.
Not because he read a lot of books, but because his parents had given the Rare Books Library with the Gutenberg Bible and all the rest. I used to say to people, they couldn't just give the regular library for this guy. They had to give the Rare Books Library to get this guy in. But let me give you another and very concrete example that goes back to the 1950s. In New York, if you wanted to be sure you could get a good doctor, and you didn't know, it's really hard to know who's going to be a good doctor, right? And you wanted to get a good doctor because your kid had a disease or whatever. In New York, it was a good idea to go ahead and get a Jewish doctor. Well, why is that? And the answer is because a lot of the doctors there had been educated at Columbia University. And Columbia University, if they had admitted all students in the 1940s and 30s, 40s, 50s, on the basis of academic talent, would have had about a 40 to 50% Jewish class. But they only admitted 5% Jews. That was their quota. And which 5% did they admit? Well, obviously, they admitted the very, very smartest. So if you didn't know who was going to be a good doctor, and how could you possibly know? You right. could definitely know that the I mean, you're if you could find out which doctors were Phi Beta Kappa, that's what you would do. But the closest thing you could do to that in New York in the 1950s was get a Jewish doctor, because you knew that that doctor would only have been admitted if he or she was the very best. And I would say right now, if you wanted to find the smartest student at Stanford or at Harvard or at Columbia or at Yale, what you would do is see if you could find an Asian American girl or boy from Manhattan. Because that student would only be admitted if that student was really smart. Well, the reverse is going to be true if you give any group, it doesn't matter which group, if you give any group a systematic advantage. You don't know in advance that it's Dean Baquet and that he's really good, but what you know is that on average, the students who've been admitted who are kind of like him are kind of like books, you know, who was admitted for some other reason. And so it's a disadvantage in that sense. But the real disadvantage is that we're getting a lot of self-segregation on campus. We're getting
exactly.
a lot of frustrated students, and we're getting students who come in wanting to be a doctor or a bio engineer or something that requires a lot of really hard courses, and they could do just fine if they were admitted to a university where their SAT scores and their high school scores were close to the median, not where they were in the expected to be in the lower portion of the class. And people can't
it's almost like kids are compelled to go to the university that's not right for them, because they become then a political human statement. Right.
Right. I mean, well, they think it's going to work out better for them if they go to that university. And for some, it does. I mean, there are plenty of students who've been admitted on affirmative action grounds who end up just doing great. There's nothing yes. wrong for them. But there are a lot of students who don't. And it's too bad you don't sort of get what's now happening with college football players, where they transfer to a university where they could do better, but it just doesn't happen. They end up dropping out, or they end up majoring in something they don't really want to major in. And it's an unfortunate situation. And you can't, it's even more unfortunate, and you guys know this all too well, you just can't talk about it. You and I can't, because we're
independent.
We're independent.
Notice Jeff was
going if I said this no. and I was untenured. If I said this and I was untenured, it wouldn't matter what field I was in. I wouldn't get tenure.
I mean, anybody calling what you were saying controversial is kind of weird to me. I mean, because my read on what you were saying and the way you're describing it is that it's not the person, you know, whoever the vessel is of knowledge that's coming to the university. It's where they come from. And understanding that background. And so if these schools are trying, you know, affirmative action is supposed to be the idea of trying to help boost up those that may have been neglected, then the Harvard should have outreach programs in every urban city in the country with their $53 billion, you know, endowment. And Yeah. Well, that's a, well, whatever it is, but well, that they should be doing that.
You are so right, and I'll tell you what they used to. Because
it's like, well, but real quick, but it's like to John. Yeah. You know, John always tells me too. We talked about this in the past, but like tomatoes, like you know, if you don't go to the best tomato vines where they are at the time, you get the best tomatoes. But you take tomatoes off of a vine that's not ready, they're just going to be not going to be that good. You know, and it's, you can't harvest without planting the soil.
Well, it's interesting what you say. What you said is exactly right. And I would just say that in the past, universities had who saw a very promising student who maybe had gone to, let's say, not Walter Payton in Chicago, but had gone to a regular public school, but was a very smart, capable, motivated student. They would often send that student at, you know, Yale or Harvard's expense to a prep school for a year to get more preparation before he or she became a first-year student. And I wish that there was more of that, but
In junior colleges, I mean, these universities should be sponsoring junior colleges and saying, hey, we're looking for the best of the best from this area. You know,
I wish that junior colleges, especially in big cities, I wish that junior colleges had honors programs in the same way that Walter Payton exists in Chicago. For people who are not from Chicago, Walter Payton is a highly competitive, elite public school, and you only get in if you're really very capable. Well, I don't see why that, in effect, can't continue for grades 13 and 14 at community colleges in big cities. And in a way, that's what City College of New York used to be like in the 30s and 40s when Jews couldn't get into Ivy League schools because of quotas. Those schools, CCNY, was just an elite school for people who lived at home with their parents and who were really smart. Well, there are a lot of Asian Americans and so forth who could benefit from those kinds of schools in big cities. But what's happened to those schools is that community colleges have been tasked in a lot of ways with remedying what's gone wrong with K-12 education.
It's remedial. They're teaching kids how to read and how to read a book, which is not the job of a college. I'm going to bring it back to when I was a kid in the business. There was a guy named Michael Dukakis. I was not a kid, but I've been established. Yeah. Michael Dukakis was running for president.
Yes.
One of the big suits had the idea that, well, you know what? Maybe Cass should cover this because he's Greek and Dukakis is Greek.
Yeah.
And I thought it was offered in a nice way, I guess. There was no malevolence there, but me being me, I was bleeping upset, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to be your little token Greek guy to translate to the Greek? I was furious, and they were all like, wait a minute, don't be like this. It was an opportunity. I'm like, well, I don't want that opportunity.
Let me tell you my favorite line about Michael Dukakis. You know, he was almost sunk by the fact that he was kind of a humorless head.
Bernard Shaw asked him the question on CNN, something like, what would you do if this guy raped your wife and killed your wife or something like that?
He could not answer the question without making a bow to political correctness. That I had forgotten that, but Bernie Shaw was a very distinguished did he get his start in Chicago?
I don't know, but I think he may have. I don't know really.
Yeah, and he was a very distinguished TV reporter, and he asked Dukakis that question, and it was, and instead of saying, well, I would be outraged, everything about me would want to kill that person, But if you ask me as a maker of public policy, I would have to restrain myself. And that's, in effect, what a lot of people have to do in public life. We have to ask what's the right thing to do, not what's the emotional thing to do. But that's not what he said.
There's one thing you should have added.
Yeah, go ahead.
And after you ask me that question and you give the response that he should have given, that you laid out, Dukakis could have said, and after the debate, I'm going to see you outside.
You know, that's what we did in my high school and elementary school. We had a lot of after school fights. I'm afraid I was in more than a few, and almost never the winner.
Oh, I was always getting punched in the stomach by Jimmy Dwyer or somebody for mouthing off.
Yeah. Why did you have him killed?
Jimmy Dwyer? No, he's doing well. I didn't have
any. I'm sorry. Oh, I misunderstood. Yeah. I thought that later you hired a hitman to do away with all your enemies, Sean.
That's how that's you know, on the day that we baptized the children, right? On that day.
Boy, that is one of the greatest scenes in all of movies, isn't it? The juxtaposition of that baptism with all the assassinations.
Well, that's going to hell. That's not even a handbasket.
Yeah.
But those were the days in journalism where people picked, I guess, you know, like you're Greek, you're black, you could talk to black people. You're Greek, you could talk to Greek people. And that was the beginning of sort of a informal quota system, and I just hated it, you know.
Well, John, I want to talk about something that's both part of your past and part of our present. And part of your past was that your parents and grandparents and so forth experienced a civil war in which the communists, backed by the Soviets, were on one side within Greece, and where NATO and the United States were on the other side. And the issues in Ukraine bring us back to some of those days. And it's important to remember that the United States gave the anti-communist forces in Greece huge amounts of resources, as well as economic resources to the people. You've talked about that. But we didn't send in troops, and it looks like that's basically the strategy we're pursuing in Ukraine.
I think there's a difference in that NATO had distinct, serious strategic security issues with Greece going under Stalin.
That's
right.
And
10% or less of the population had guns and began to slaughter the Greek people, and so they capitulated. The left, you know, this informs my worldview, right?
I would love to hear that, John. Tell me. Well, first of all, tell us a little about. You've told me that your dad actually had been given support by the U.S. Well, tell us a little.
They gave us. They gave the family a mule.
Truman the mule.
And they were given a big, long-legged mule. This is part of the Marshall Plan. And Truman was not big, long-legged, and black. He had short legs. My grandfather wanted a short-legged mule with a short back because of the strength involved there, right? Just leverage,
right?
And which is why I get along well with Willie Wilson, because he plowed with a mule, and so did my dad. And it wasn't for hobby, you know, Al Gore says a hobby, you know, plowing. So they survived. They were able to survive. And the reason they were able to survive was because of what you said, NATO and the United States, the Marshall Plan. But before that, they had to get rid of, they had to take over the country. They had to take it back.
From the communists. Is who? Meaning the West.
the West and the forces of the anti-communists and the forces of the king. When my father, there's a beautiful square in Athens called Syndagma, and it's where the finest hotels and my favorite hotel in the world, the Grand Breton, is there, right on the corner, in which where I stayed the last time I was at a Greek protest where communists were throwing rocks. This is just a few years ago. But it, during the war, my father had helped the British flyers who were downed in Greece get out. He would he was part of that resistance, but not the left-wing resistance. They were the groups were fighting each other, you know, because they knew what was coming. So he would get them out, and one day a guy came. He was blue-eyed and blonde-haired, and he was in the woods, and he whispered to my father, "Hey, psst, hey, help me. Can you help me? I'm British." And some reason my father became afraid. He could feel the sixth sense, you know, something.
Didn't think he was British.
He didn't know what was going on, and he just pretended, feigned ignorance, and rode away on his bicycle.
Yes. I see.
He was a grown man riding a bicycle because they had no car.
Right.
But what happened was that night, the Carabinieri came into the general store and restaurant, a little cafeteria that my father, my papu had, my grandfather. And they came in and broke down the doors. They had, you know, their troops with the machine guns ready.
Yeah.
And and out of the car walks the officer.
Ah.
Blue-eyed and blonde hair.
Ah.
And he spoke perfect English and perfect Greek. He was obviously a nobleman, you know, well-educated. Mm-hmm. And part of that police force, occupying force, they took my father away for 3 days, and he never said what happened to him.
That it must have been awful if he wouldn't say.
But what happened later?
Yeah,
later he and one day they were dragging him out. My grandfather was grabbing for a knife, and my aunts were everyone screaming, and my father just said to my papu, my grandfather, "Asto, you know, leave it, you know, don't grab a knife, leave it alone."
Right.
So they went. So then, when he was released after 3 days, he didn't have anything to tell them because he didn't know anything, right? There was no. They had like secret cells, but they were very, very limited because of that reason. If you got caught, so they let him out, and then about a week or two later, the officer came back to the house, and he said, "Spiro, my father's name. I hear you're a good hunter. They talk about you as a hunter in the mountains. Would you show me where you go? I would like to go hunting."
Huh.
And my father said that was when he realized the captain of the Carabinieri would kill him.
Yeah.
Out where nobody could see.
So he went up.
Yeah.
But his friend, Kolya, from our village, Rizes, now I'm sure Rizotis listen to this and they know the story too. So his friend, Kolya, said, "I'm coming with you." And he said, no, they're going to kill me. No, my father said. He goes, "I'm coming with Capitania. Let me come, you know."
So he
went up to the mountain with my father. And the captain showed them his beautiful hunting rifle when they were up there. Mm-hmm. Beyond the monastery, up past the, the monastery, Aya Marina, and beyond that into the high mountain. And my father was looking at Kolya thinking,
you know, Kolya would try to use it and kill the captain. And he kept hoping, like closing his eyes and just basically praying that the captain would not kill them. I mean, that he would not kill the captain because probably there were no bullets in it.
Yeah.
Right? Or something. Yeah. There's some the firing pin, something. You know, you're not going to give your enemies a gun, a loaded gun. So they came back. I guess they shot something or didn't shoot something. I don't know. They got back home, and my grandmother, Yaya Angela, had fixed a big pot of yingandes, which are the lima beans in tomato.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. Yeah.
And my dad and Kolya ate, and that was the greatest meal that they've ever had in their lives.
Oh, yeah.
And then I love it. When my father.
But how did that inform you? You said well, that my informed father, the way you think about things.
Well, my father left for the United States and promised Kolya he would bring him a gun. And he never got back there for, you know, it took 35 years. We all got back there.
Yeah.
And my dad got this beautiful Browning, I mean, top of the line Browning shotgun, 12 gauge for Kolya. And that was difficult to get through the airport. It took bribes,
sure.
You know, cash bribes, American dollars, Greek drachmas, everything. So we got it through, and they gave him the gun in the middle of the village square.
Wow.
And all the cousins,
John, it's just so touching to hear you. I mean, you clearly almost can't get through this, right?
Well, listen, Charlie, the reason why all this stuff, why I'm informed by this, does this inform me?
Right.
I just edited a piece by Matt Rosenberg on, you know, Milt's son on my site. And he's talking about Marcuse and how the issue and the deconstruction of Chicago and Illinois and Cook County.
Right, right.
And I said, they're all about force. They have always been about force. And I look back, my life.
Yeah.
The communists, when they took over Greece, they grabbed the children first and shipped them to Stalin. To Russia. They took the children away from the people.
Yeah.
And it was all about force, just like, you know, these teachers they think now that they are the ones who own the children. It's not the parents, it's the teachers. Same thing.
You know,
it's all about force.
Force and control. One of the things that, the communists did and the fascists did as well, is that when they took over, the first thing they did was eliminated all the sources of independent voluntary organization, like the Boy Scouts or the Girl Scouts.
Or the Lions Club or the
Knights of Columbus. Things,
yeah.
Those could not exist. And so, when I was writing about some of the issues related to affirmative action we talked about earlier, I was thinking about the issue of Harvard. The lawsuit that's before the Supreme Court involves one case involving Harvard University, which is a private university, and one involving University of North Carolina, which is a public university. But so one of the issues that Supreme Court will have to decide is, does it matter that Harvard is private? But in fact, one of the things that's happened over many years, and it's been a standard progressive claim, is that there's almost no distinction between public and private anymore. And what they say is, well, Harvard takes a lot of public dollars, which is true. A lot of students get aid, and the faculty get research grants, and a lot of this comes from the U.S. government, and therefore it has to obey U.S. Public rules as if it were a public university. And it's worth people thinking about that, whether and when President Biden said that all large businesses have to obey the vaccine mandate. And here, I don't want to talk about the substantive content of the mandate. I favor getting a vaccine and so forth. But the idea was that if you were a large business, you were, in effect, under the government's control, as if you were a public entity, like the Department of Motor Vehicles.
More than 100 employees, yeah.
Right. And so it's a very – and by the way, they extended a lot of that to small businesses on the grounds that all small businesses are, quote, engaged in interstate commerce. Well, why is my corner restaurant engaged in interstate commerce? And the answer is all their silverware came from another state. Maybe it's the eggs crossed the state line and so forth.
The chickens.
It's worth, yeah, it's worth people. Well, first you steal a chicken, but it's worth people thinking about the extent to which we want to allow people to do things voluntarily outside of state control, even if what they do offends us, offends our moral sensibilities. Maybe they discriminate against Greeks or Jews or blacks or whatever it is, and that offends us. But it's a private group.
Yes.
Should they be allowed to do that? And the counter to it is not just that that we shouldn't allow that discrimination, but in effect, by preventing it, what we do is we allow state authority, in general, federal authority, to expand to control more and more of our lives. And oh, I think that's a big public debate worth having.
No crisis should be left to go to waste, is what Rahm Emanuel said.
Right.
And just as the left wing in Greece used force, today's governments in the West also use force. Look at Chicago. Look at the Chicago Way. That's the name of this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Look at, you know, you step out of line, they will use the government hammer against you. So all my life I've been fighting this idea that force can compel you to give up your liberty and your reason, and which is what informs me.
Well, I think that's very important. But I would just add, if I can push back just a little bit.
Yeah, John, please do.
I think that governments and so forth that rely only on force find it very hard to do all the things they want. They have to convince a lot of people that they're doing the right thing. The term is often called legitimation. And I think if you look at, going back, let's say, to affirmative action and so forth, this a lot of what's happening in places like New Trier, or, you know, schools in Winnetka or fancy suburbs and so forth, yeah, is you have a very pervasive sense that all minorities are victims, all whites, by which they really mean two-parent, bourgeois value kind of families, right, and so forth, are oppressors, even though, you know, mom and dad have done nothing to oppress anybody. They work at a law firm or
right. Mom and dad are working two jobs. Yeah.
And they're, so then the question is, not the kind of mailed fist of the state, but a lot of these policies winning support, because people believe they're the best way to move forward. So this, a podcast like this with, and the writing you do at John Cass News, make sense politically, in part because there is a battle for ideas. What Marcuse and the people who were part of the Frankfurt School and so forth, cultural Marxism, what's being debated there is important because ideas matter and bad ideas matter. And our country is just suffused with bad ideas. And
why is this?
Well, because all I was going to say, what I was going to say is that the crucial thing is to allow pushback against them. And that's what's so disturbing about social media today is that they exclude alternative ideas.
You exclude alternative ideas. You don't even speak them. You can't even say them. You're afraid to even bring them up, not in this podcast.
Well, you were an outlier. You were an outlier at the Tribune when you were still there. The people wanted to get rid of you because you were a dissonant voice.
And the reason, look, it's force, whether it's forcing, you know, by mob and social media mob on media, it's force in government. What it is, it's all the same. It's about, you will conform. The beatings will continue until morale improves. Exactly. And I don't like that.
Well, I was told that that's how you and Jeff were. You had told him that the beatings will continue until the ratings on this podcast were even higher.
Yes. Absolutely.
Jeff, we've been talking for a while. I want to hear your views on some of this.
Yeah, no, I mean, I love what I always tell you this. I get lost listening to the two of you in these conversations because it's so interesting. But I love the idea, you know, you're talking about oppression or force, but it's like this idea that safety, like we're trying to protect people, but you see governments use various, you know, we'll call it themes, if you will, but it's usually it comes back to safety. You know, these are terrorist groups within us, or these are racist groups within us, or these are, and certainly there are those groups exist and they are doing things, but for the most part, they're well tracked by our authorities. It's just this idea that, you know, where does it go then? And so now, the safety of our health. Well, people should be able to have make a private group and do something that's dangerous. I mean, you can't regulate people to be safe. You try in the corporate world, but I think you hit it on the head with the idea that, you know, social media now makes it so dangerous, and that it's a use of force that's so subtle because you don't even notice that it's not there. That unless you're actually told, you don't realize the other side. You don't even attach yourselves to the other side in any way. It's just, I don't know if people realize it. I think you see it a little bit because more and more people are, you know, dropping off of social media or disengaging from things like that.
We're moving to the social media where all the opinions are the same as theirs.
Right, which is even more dangerous because then you don't know what's going on there when things are happening behind closed doors, which I know I was just kind of, you know, ringing the bell for, but when you push people into corners like that and they have to coalesce in groups of three because they fear, that's when people get anxious or get, you know, I don't know, for lack of a better word, crazy.
You can't even talk about the effect of masks on little children or children with disabilities. This willy-nilly mask thing that they don't work. You can't even discuss it in media. If you bring it up like on a talk show, oh my God, your producer will run and say, oh, please, please don't, you know, right?
Well, this is an interesting point, and it goes back to why free speech is valuable. Now, there are always limits to free speech. You can't use a bullhorn outside of people's home at 2 a.m., and you can't do certain things that would directly threaten people. But I would point to two really valuable points about free speech. One is that sometimes you will hear an argument, or the listeners, it may not be you, but a third party who's listening, will hear an argument that they hadn't considered before and will find it persuasive. And the second, and of course, that's why some people want to exclude free speech. because they are fearful that the other arguments will be persuasive. And then the second one is something that every good litigator knows, which is in order to make their own argument effective, they really have to know what the other side is arguing, what its best arguments are, so that they can sharpen their arguments in opposition to them. My feeling is that if you go to Berkeley, let's say, your views are kind of standard left liberal Berkeley views, you just won't have a very sharp ability to debate the other side. I think that's kind of what happened to somebody like Kamala Harris, right? She came up in California politics, right? She never had to debate anybody who was on the other side. She never faced news people who asked her tough questions. She just cruised to the top. And as soon as she hit choppy waters, she sank.
I thought your shoes.
The only debate she had was asking Willie Brown whether they were going to go out for Chinese or, right?
Yeah, but if you even bring that up, what people would say is not only your being a sexist, but Willie Brown was exploiting her. But these are two adult people, and she was getting something she wanted, and he was getting something he wanted.
I'd love to be able to smoke pot with Kamala Harris and hear her talk about how she jailed all those people.
Oh, man.
Oh, God. Right? But, I mean, you know, look, this is part of the dilemma of American politics. You feel like you've got a gerontocracy on one side with old losing ideas, and then on the other side you have people fulminating and sort of trying a kind of radical populism that is refusing to acknowledge that in Trump's case that he lost the election. And I think you hear both sides saying that the other side is a danger to democracy, and in a certain sense, they're both right. That's the tragedy. It's not that one side is right. It's that the threats to our constitutional democracy are coming from all sides.
The tomahawks are out, right? They've been out for a while. And
even that's a phrase that you can't say.
Why? What did I? Who did I offend?
Tomahawks.
You're appropriating culture, John.
See, I mean.
Oh wait. Oh, so it's okay for So it's okay for Michigan State to put a Spartan in a green uniform with a green cape? Come on.
I would think about the Fighting Irish, John.
The Spartans wore red, and they never conquered us. Okay, we're the Arcadians. But the Spartans wore red. They did not wear green, and they did not look like a foam little monster.
Oh, this is just this anti-Michigan State rabble rousing, John.
10 to 10.
I feel like we're devolving into a Facebook comment section.
No, it was 10 to 10. The tie. Bubba Smith was on their side. Eric Parsegan was leading the Fighting Irish. 10 to 10 tie. Yes, I remember.
Guys, this is so much fun. I always love these conversations, and I never know which way they're going to go, except that the last several times I have been pleased that your father's mule, Truman, has made an appearance.
Truman kicked my dad in the head when my dad was plowing, and he told my Thea, I forgot which Thea. I think it was Thea Matina. Matina, he says, Elada, like he's on the ground with blood coming out of his head. Elada, and he said, take my hair. Don't touch my head till I tell you. Take the hair on the back of my head. Lift it up.
Yeah.
To cover my brains. He thought
God.
He thought the whole top of his head had been kicked off.
Oh,
so put it. Tough guy, right? So put he was just lying there telling her this, and she's like, I can't do it. I can't. So anyway, he healed up. he healed up.
Yeah.
And from then on, at least our family has been Republican.
And you know what the Democrats would say? They would say some of those brains probably did fall out.
That's what they would say. Yeah.
It's great to talk to you, Jeff and John.
See you, buddy.
Thanks, Charles.
Thanks, Charles. Thanks so much. I love it when Charlie comes on. I just do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love learning, and I always learn something from Charles, and it's always enlightening. So, and it's a great conversation. He's a real thinker, that's for sure. And I wanted to pick up two things from the pod earlier. We're talking about Bernard Shaw. He did get his start in Chicago. That was correct. And point of reference, Walter Payton Prep was the high school we were talking about earlier, kind of the elite school. And in the true Chicago way, it's the alma mater to many a former governor and or mayor's children. So
let's put it this way. If clout, they say clout doesn't count, but you know what? It does, right? Yeah. Everyone, all parents know this. Get your kid into a magnet school.
Man.
But that's what force is all about. When you have people capitulating and kneeling and then saying it was their idea, that it was it's a virtue to capitulate. That's what frosts my behind. I'll tell you that. Anyway, for Charles Lipston, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, writer of many articles, you can go to charleslipson.com and read them, or find him in, you know, The Spectator, The Real Clear Politics, wherever. And for Jeff Carlin, my friend, co-host, podcast master, the guy who got me into this. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, proud, independent journalist now at johncassnews.com, where we don't kneel to anyone. Thank you for visiting on another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.